Hi, I'm Andrew.
And I'm Spencer.
And we're here at the Slowdown's New York headquarters. You're listening to Time Sensitive, a podcast where we profile curious and courageous people in business, the arts, and beyond who have a distinct perspective on time.
Andrew, we're doing this. It's episode one.
Yep.
This week we have Peter Sarsgaard on. Why Peter?
So Peter's a guy that I've known in New York for about 20 years. And, you know, people know him as an actor, phenomenal actor. But I find it really interesting how he spends the time between the acting jobs. He's ultra runner. He's a mandolin player. He keeps an apple orchard. Kind of anything he gets curious about, he finds the time to go deep. And so that's what I wanted to talk to him about today.
It's great. Let's get into it. Here's Andrew with Peter.
You know, it's funny. When I think when people think of Peter Sarsgaard, they think of the actor Peter Sarsgaard.
Mm-hmm.
Probably the villainous actor Peter Sarsgaard,
yeah.
Which is pretty funny.
My day job.
Yeah, but there are also a lot of people, most of your friends, people that know you, that don't think of you as an actor first.
Yeah, I don't think I think of myself as an actor first.
What do you think of yourself as?
Just like a lucky guy. I mean, I think of myself as someone who, I remember once being told that a lot of the great poets were people that had a lot of time on their hands. So like W.S. Merwin, this was told to me, I don't know this is a fact, but had some degree of wealth and so had time on his hands. Or even someone like Lucian Freud had time on his hands. And so I feel like what acting has given me that not every actor deals with well is having time on my hands. So luckily, I'm someone who knows how to use that because there are actors that don't know how to use that. And of course, it can be a time of wild self-destruction. But no, I fill it with all kinds of things. And I, you know, as you know, I tend to get on a jag for a while. Usually what happens is I'll get on a jag about something and then something else tangential will come up and then they kind of join, you know. I'll try to marry music and running an orchard, small orchard, you know.
Well, I want to talk specifically about two areas of your life that you've somewhat mastered or in the process of mastering, kind of in spite of your career, which is funny.
Yeah.
First one being running.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Well, that's a very handy one in terms of my career because the great thing about running is that you can do it anywhere and you need nothing, you know. And it's meditative as well as being obviously physical. So for me, it's the time that my creative mind comes to life, you know, like while running some amount, but especially right after. That's like a really fertile time, you know.
And what I mean by in spite of your career is you may have gotten into running because of a film that never happened.
I did, yeah. I was going to direct and I wrote the screenplay for Born to Run and then the movie fell apart. It was a very long, sad ending. I think part of the ending was when Caballo Blanco, one of the main characters in it, died. Really the main character in it, who was an American who was living in the mountains of the in Mexico. And, well,
let's just take you back a little bit to what is Born to Run, because people may not know that.
Oh, Born to Run. Born to Run was an extremely popular book that was about that in our true nature, there was a runner in each and every one of us. We are the running people. We are humans are specifically good at long-distance running because of the ability to sweat and because of the way we're built on two legs, you know.
And so this book comes out, you read it.
Yeah. I read it on the set of The Green Lantern. I actually finished it right before a take on the Green Lantern. I was sitting there in a huge prosthetic head, and I remember closing the book and thinking, you know, there's something about this book that needs to be seen, you know. And also, I liked the idea. I mean, I've since worked with Errol Morris, who did this, but like, I liked the idea of combining something that had elements of documentary and feature, because there's things in that book, some kind of convincing pop science about our origins on the southern tip of Africa and it getting hotter and being able to run down our food, the Running Man theory. That would be great doc style. There's a really charismatic scientist who's in the book who I got to know and I thought would be good in the movie. Anyway, the whole thing is now being done in a completely different way. And I really do wish them luck, but it...
maybe not by people who actually became serious runners in the process of learning.
No, and so I had grown up being athletic. My dad, you know, ran marathons, but I wouldn't say he was like a sporty person. He just liked it. I think I know why he liked it, because it's... everyone respects that time after a while. It's like brushing your teeth, except it takes an hour. And you just walk out the door and do it, and that time is completely yours. I mean, no one can catch you. No one can walk in the room. So that's what's amazing about it on some level, in addition to all the other obvious things. Obviously, it's also hard on your body. So, you know, yeah, and this book was also about how we are uniquely adapted to do it, so it shouldn't hurt us. We shouldn't be having to be shod in really thick soled shoes in order to be able to do something that we're adapted to do perfectly well. And in fact, maybe those things are bad for us. So I found, though, that no matter what I did, I always had to pay attention to whether or not I was getting injured. Now, I would say that's probably true for almost anything you do, even sitting on the sofa. So,
what's the longest you ever ran?
I ran a 50K. There was also I ran a 50K all in one go. I also used to do this thing when my wife was filming in Pittsburgh, which is really hilly. And I like running hills because I like going down them mainly. But, you know, there's like some sort of payoff for hard work. And I used to keep track of how far I would run over the course of the day, and I would call it like a running day. And I'd run to the record store, and I wouldn't be buying things, but sometimes I'd wear a backpack. And I was running pretty slowly. But I imagine on one of those days, I might have run that or a little bit longer.
When I think about your kind of passion for running that happened, it happened because of this.
Because of the book?
Because of the project.
Sort of. I mean, the project, I would say, reignited something that I had always had in me. When I was a kid growing up, I had this friend named Eli Torgerson, who's a guy I still know, who's really, at that point in my life, he was the best endurance athlete I knew. This was a kid that just, I played soccer with him, but he was really an endurance athlete. And he would take me at like 4 o'clock in the morning on these epic runs. And I go running with him, and he was just way better at it than I was. And he was a fast runner. And so I looked up to him and his ability, the way that young men do with one another. And to this day, he's still someone high contact. I'm actually going to work in Albuquerque, and he's an anesthesiologist in Albuquerque. I think he won a race there running in snowshoes through the desert. And he also bikes, and he's won many bike races in the Albuquerque Mountains. So I'm going to bring my bike down there and get crushed by him once again. But, you know, I used to have this thing. I really liked being behind someone running. It's like having a pacer, especially if they're a little faster. And I think that that's always been a position that I'm comfortable with. There's something about that. I don't like leading out, you know. I like tucking right behind, even if I'm racing someone. I'm the type of runner that would do that until the last 10 feet and then go for it.
And the project, you know, you took it all the way. I mean, mm-hmm. And developed close relationships.
Oh, yeah, I wrote it, did the whole thing. We had financiers. But, you know, what ended up happening, I actually met Caballo Blanco.
Who was?
Anyone who's read the book would know this guy. It's sort of the heart of the book. He's this guy who lived in the mountains in Mexico. He befriended the Tarahumara Indians, who are an ancient tribe that runs. They're called the Running People, or the Rarámuri. They're on the license plate in Chihuahua, Mexico. And he ran with them, and he ran hundreds of miles at a time with them. And they do that, you know, men, women, children. It's one way they've been able to survive for so long living in this area. And also before the logging roads, it was the only way to get around. So everything has changed somewhat since then. But he went down there and he just dropped out of society. This guy had no income, job, assets, nothing. And he started this race down there basically for those people to try to raise money to help them, because these logging roads are going in, and then the cartels use the logging roads to go down and plant drugs, and they basically enslave them to, you know, mule the drugs and stuff. And it's become a messy situation. And also, since civilization has touched them, you know, there have been lots of problems within the community. And so he ran this race to try to help them. Well, this writer went down and he met him and ended up writing this book about all these racers who came down to run this race in the mountains there for the Tarahumara, including the best runner in the U.S. over 100 miles, which is Scott Jurek, who's a very good friend of mine. And Scott, you know, was like, is Scott going to win, or is the best Tarahumara runner going to win? And I think in the end, who wins is really not that important, I would say, in the end. But anyway, I thought it was a really interesting book about the clash of modernity with this sort of our past, which we romanticize and we have all these feelings about, but also that it's our past as being a people that are uniquely gifted at running, all of us, according to his thesis in this book. And Dr. Lieberman up at, I think he's up at Harvard, who's the scientist who talks about the running man theory. So anyway, it's something that I went, right, I remember I'm a runner. I used to run with Eli. This is something I can do. And I was at a point in my life where, like, you know, things were going well in terms of my job and that kind of stuff, but physically I felt like I was deteriorating. So I was coming up on 40, and I guess I also wanted to...
You were shooting Night and Day with Tom Cruise, who gave you a bit of advice.
Like, yeah, yeah.
I'd like to hear that story.
Tom Cruise, definitely.
Tell me a little bit about that, because that was the predecessor.
That happened right before this, right. So I was shooting in Spain with Tom Cruise and Cameron Diaz, with James Mangold directing this movie. And we're shooting in Spain and Austria. And it was a long time. And, you know, you get on location and you're just sort of, you're not on your best behavior. So I was deteriorating pretty quickly. It's also the type of movie where you go in and the type of movie I'm used to shooting, you go in and it's the day is so filled in terms of making artistic decisions that you can't actually keep up. Part of the skill that I'm good at is like making one and letting it go, making one, letting it go, and not Monday morning quarterbacking anything. I let everybody figure it out later, but I just go with my instinct, go with my instinct, go with my instinct. On that movie, it was like line up the kick, shoot it through, line up another one. And it just all felt very slow and thought out. And it was difficult for me. All those movies are, I think, difficult for a lot of actors. And the ones who are good at it, God bless them. I mean, they kind of wear two hats at once. So I was on that movie and Tom was just like, I don't actually remember what he said then, but so we finished the movie and I just went on like a total dive into running, and I quit drinking and I just went like on a health bender, and it was really like stark, I think, to a lot of the people around me. They're like, oh my God, he's lost his mind, because I was also approaching 40. And then it was at an Oscar party, and no one had said anything to me like about it. I think people were just sort of looking at me, even the people closest to me. Tom Cruise, 2.5 months into it, at an Oscar party, crosses the room and he goes, "What's happened to you? Something's going on with you, right?" I said, "Yeah." And then he went, "Great." I was like, "That's amazing." That is partly his gift, right? Is being like hyper aware, hyper perceptive of everything around him. Now, I'm sure it doesn't always serve him. Anything that you're fantastic at is also your Achilles heel.
But you knew for sure he was concerned about the state of your health.
Oh yeah, totally, totally. I did.
And encouraged
I actually mostly knew at that moment what all the other sort of, you know, little things that he said meant, you know, because in the moment you're just like, yeah, I'm just eating another whatever hot dog, you know, but like, or drinking another beer, but like, yeah, it was at that moment that I went, oh, he's tapped in.
Yeah. And I mean, this is sort of what we've been talking about in a lot of ways is, and why I'm interested in having you on the show today, is this idea that, you know, projects happen, projects don't happen. It doesn't really matter.
No.
Because the fact that Born to Run wasn't made,
yeah,
may have been the greatest thing for you.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I actually say something even further. The periods where I've not worked as an actor, and I've gone through periods that are pretty long where I just didn't work. And then like coming up now, I mean, actually, I didn't work from spring of last year, I think. Yeah. End of the spring last year, maybe end of May, beginning of June, all the way through November. And then I did 2 weeks on a movie with Liev Schreiber and Marissa Tomei that Mark Meyer directed. But it was just a little thing. And now I will start working again on March 4th. But it will be a very intense period now. I'm doing two things simultaneously. I'll be shooting March 4th through the end of June. And that period, let's just take that period. Like that period over the summer, I mean, I got whooping cough. Like lots of stuff happened that wasn't great. And actually, even running-wise, physically, I wasn't like doing as well as I have been doing, mainly because of the whooping cough. But it's like that type of hibernation, you go, another part of your mind really opens. And as you know, I went to go see this guy in New Hampshire, Michael Phillips, who's, I would say, one of the most interesting guys to talk to about and having an orchard. You know, he's an apple grower, but he's also a teacher up in northern New Hampshire, right near the Canadian border. And he has lots of really interesting ideas about prophylactically enhancing the health of your trees to protect them against disease. So instead of like, you know, putting stuff on them that kills things, you're putting stuff on them that makes bacteria and mycorrhizal fungi grow around them to protect them against the bad stuff. Now, that seems very, like, I mean, it's very technical, and I went for the whole workshop, and I took lots of notes, and I learned lots of things. And I'm sure I remember half of them at this point, but I'm also, to me, he's a kind of artist. So when I meet someone like that during that period, I'm thinking about him and his life and what he's devoted it to as much as what I'm thinking about the information. And it makes me think about my life and the way I approach it. And or even the way I get into music sometimes. I mean, I was saying that sometimes these things converge.
Well, I wanted to get to the Bill Monroe project.
Yeah, and the Bill Monroe project is another good example.
Because these are the two examples I can think of that you know, if I asked you, you know, why do you act? Why are you an actor? Well, there's a complicated sort of answer for that. But I would expect you to maybe say, you know, because it's the vehicle to kind of learn and explore the world on my own time scale.
But it's also, it's really just the end of the process in a way. It's sort of like, I'm mostly interested in everything that happens when I'm not acting. And my acting is just the expression of my life, right? So, and it happens in such a short period of time. People don't realize this. It's like super condensed. It's over before you know it. My gift during that time is really in letting it rip. You know, my life I've been living, I've gotten interested in the things I've been interested in that may either have literally something to do with the project. Like I was learning about astronauts and I'm playing an astronaut, but that's rare. With me, it's mostly I've been meeting people, I've been living my life, accumulating whatever kind of, whatever you want to call it, information, I guess. And then that winds up in there. So I'm cross-pollinating in a way that's very random.
It's random, but then there are certain things, I can think of maybe two or three, that you have had the opportunity and the excuse to give a hyper-focused sort of period of education on.
Sure.
And so the Bill Monroe story is...
I'll give an example of that. Yeah, so the Bill Monroe story is interesting because of who I met off of that project, meeting Michael Daves, of course. But... So the Bill Monroe project came to me from the guy who was going to direct it and wrote it. He wrote the first draft. And my wife was interested in playing Bess, who was Bill Monroe's girlfriend. So we went to Callie Curry and T-Bone. They're a couple. Callie wrote Thelma and Louise, of course. And Callie was like, I'm going to rewrite this whole thing. I know Bill Monroe. I know the story. I got it. And she was really onto something. And then T-Bone, of course, I mean, it's just like a musical goldmine there. That's the only guy that I think that I know of that invented an entire musical genre. You know, it's like, who invented jazz? A lot of people invented jazz. Bluegrass, it was Bill Monroe and his bluegrass boys that first played that music, which was developed in the Appalachian Mountains around Kentucky. And involves Scottish music and Eastern European music and shape note singing and all kinds of stuff coming together. And so I got really interested in that. And I wasn't sure if I was going to play and sing in the movie, but I wanted to feel like I could. And, you know, I was playing someone who's really a virtuosic singer and easier to play like him a lot of the time on the mandolin because it's a chop most of the time, maybe not the solos. He didn't play like Chris Thiele or something. So T-Bone first introduced me to John Paul Jones of Led Zeppelin because I was in London and he was like, I know a guy who has a mandolin and he'll come down. John Paul Jones had a Lore mandolin. There's, I think, four or five of them in existence. It's an extremely expensive object that should be behind glass. And I remember he just handed it to me and he gave me some tuners that said his name on them, you know. John Paul Jones, he showed me how to hold the mandolin in cool ways because he sort of assumed, probably rightly, that I just needed to look like I had some game, you know? So he was like, you might take a knee, you might hold it out here. So I met him and, you know, that sounds really exciting. And I am a huge Led Zeppelin fan and I'm a huge fan of him. But then, you know, I was just learning how to be a presence on stage. Which I felt like is something I could do intuitively anyway. Then he, when I came back to Brooklyn, he introduced me to Michael Daves, who's just a virtuosic guitarist and singer. Everyone should go and listen to him. I mean, his album with Chris Thiele, Sleep With One Eye Open, is just a marvel of an album. You can watch him online, plays, just virtuosic.
And an incredible human being.
And an incredible human being who's my friend now. We do midnight mass together at the local church. I've helped raise money with him to fix the church's ceiling. We were friends. And I started taking mandolin lessons and he was helping me sing like Bill Monroe. And then the whole movie, like a lot of little movies like this, we went and recorded the music in Nashville with T-Bone. And it was a marvelous experience. Everyone came out for T-Bone for this thing. I mean, it's bluegrass. And Del McCurry was singing my part some of the time. He's an incredible singer. And I had a whole journey with it. And then I started to sense, because the musicians weren't getting paid and stuff, and a lot of movies are put together like this, but that there was a little bit of wishful thinking going on. And that's to be kind about it. You know, people will say we have the money so that they can get the money. And then if they don't get the money and they keep saying we have the money, and they start to get into criminal territory. And this guy really wanted to make the movie. He was the only person, the director, I'm sparing everyone his name because it's not important.
Yeah.
He was the only person that knew where the money was coming from exactly, how much there was.
But it fell apart as Born to Run fell apart in sort of dramatic ways. But the point is,
yeah,
you can run your ass off and you can play music.
I can run my ass off and I can play music. And then what happened is, this is the end of that story, actually. Several years go by. I've been playing music. I meet Ornette Coleman. I actually played with Ornette Coleman before he died. I'm not vouching for my ability because I played drums with him and I don't really even play the drums, but Ornette said that didn't matter. But I went in really deep thinking about music. I started teaching music to both of my children, who are both now deeply into playing music. I've always listened to it and thought about it, but I started thinking about it in a way that was like, it's not off limits to me. It's a lot of people think of music as like that is, oh, that's something off limits to me, or even running too. That's something that I don't really do. What if, think of any other animal in the animal kingdom looking at us with these crazy ways of kind of amplifying our voices, whether it be through electronics or acoustics or whatever. They think we're amazing or mad or something, but we're clearly all hook, line, and sinker for it. As a society, look at the way we listen to it. We are all knowledgeable about it, even on the most simple level. And running. What you say to a room full of children, you say like, who in this room runs? And they're 8 years old. Every hand goes up in that room. To a room full of adults, suddenly it's like two people. I think there's a story there that's worth exploring.
Well, they're both hooked into time.
Yeah. And about getting back to our true nature as people, you know, and they are both hooked up into time. So anyway, I do that. And then this movie comes along that I did, which was at the time called Palimpsest, which just was at Sundance. And it seems like it's successful. I have a hard time telling.
But
The Sound of Silence. So the reaction has been extremely positive about it. That movie is so arcane. It's about a person who's mapping out the root tonics of every neighborhood in Manhattan and believes that sound is affecting our everyday behavior. And the way to be happier is to try to manipulate it so that suddenly, you know, you're vibing at an A flat minor in your apartment instead of a G major or some cacophonous chord. And he's trying to help people this way. And I really do think that it's just all, I got into the idea of that movie because of where my head was at from that other movie
Human
a long
Connection.
Time ago. Yeah. It's like I dropped bluegrass on some level, which I still love. I mean, I've always loved all kinds of music, but then I just started thinking about this idea of who we are as people and our relationship to sound, and that kind of abstract idea really interests me also.
Well, you know? With running as well, there's this interplay between loneliness and human connection.
Yeah.
In both music and running.
Yeah. And breath. And much of music and much of running, you know. I mean, that guy that I showed you on the subway this morning, I don't love his flute playing. It's fine. His flute playing is really an excuse for his singing. And one of the things that's really cool about his singing, I can tell as an actor when I watch him, is the way that he uses his breath. He's very clever about really supporting it. And it's irregular. It's very, very, very wild to watch him.
I want to talk about two other things that are also about time, but and like deburies your life. Do you want more coffee?
No, I'm good.
Two other areas of your life that I think came later than mm-hmm. running and music that are kind of your current passions, which is gardening
mm-hmm.
or just general growing organic material and writing.
Yeah.
And I want to hear from you about these two areas of life in terms of time.
Uh-huh.
So I think about kind of earth time
uh-huh.
with gardening. Tell me a bit about...
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's all about time, right? I mean, it's literally about time. When you get your seed packet, it says this takes 160 days to grow or whatever. So you know I'm not going to grow it in this part of the world. But you are deeply connected to a sense of time change, especially up here in the Northeast where the seasons are so dramatic. It's so hot and it's so cold. And if you're out there every day, which during the summer I am, and I'm, you know, like a vegetable garden to me is nice because it's popular in your family because you have something to show for it. I actually also really, I would say perennials are something that I really get mostly interested in because that's a plant that you're dealing with year after year. You're coming back to it. Maybe you've done something to help it. Maybe you're just watching it. But to see that type of change happen, and, you know, of course, everyone thinks it's really slow. It's actually remarkably fast to me. You know, I planted some pear trees 2 years ago. So this year I might take one piece of fruit from them. But then the next year there's going to start to be fruit. And that, when you first plant it and you go, oh, it's going to be 4 years till I get a pear. You know, that seems like not even worth it. But then I guess I don't view the event as the pear. I view the event as the whole continuation of the whole thing all the way up into when it dies. Yeah, I even like had to take down an apple tree because, you know, the person who planted it there didn't anticipate how wet it was going to turn out to be in that spot. And so I took it down. But I actually also took some amount of joy in doing that because then I turned it into wood chips and I put it on the other apple trees, which is nothing an apple tree likes more than that because it's the mycorrhizal fungi. But living with a piece of property over a period of time and making it not just more fertile, but more valuable, not just to you, but to everything around you. I think that's also because I'm in the middle of the national forest. So I'm thinking, oh, the bear isn't really going to like this pear tree, you know?
Well, and this sort of bifurcation of your time now between the urban environment where you normally live in Brooklyn
yeah.
and living up in the national forest, north of New York, you know, you're using it to garden, you're using it to live your life basically and connect deeply with nature, but you're also using it in this new practice you have, which is writing.
Yeah.
I mean, not that it's not that new, but you have been writing. So I kind of want to hear from you a bit about, well, writing in general, but how you think about time
yeah.
on the page.
Sure. So writing in general, writing is actually the first thing that I ever got psyched about in my life. And it was the first thing I was ever told I was good at. I was a really, really poor student let's have him evaluated, poor student, and see what's up with him.
You also moved 12 times.
I moved.
We're going to get to that after, but let's stay with writing.
I moved a ton. So I'll
unpack your childhood in a second.
Yeah, that's fine. I took a test to get into high school where you had to write, and they reacted so positively to it that they put me in all these fancy classes that I didn't belong in because I still was a poor student. I could just write well. But I knew I could write well because people started to respond to it. And it's something that I actually have done in private, almost the way that some people play music in private. You know, they never play it publicly. I've done it in private for virtually my entire life. Only recently, what you're talking about is recently I've been encouraged by a lot of the people around me to write something and then share it with them. I've shared my writing over the years with like one person here or there, but very, very rarely. Because I really like the practice of doing it. I think to a lot of people that's hard to understand, but to me it's sort of like, it's probably how like knitting would be to someone, but it's more involved than that, obviously. Because my child knits, and that looks like sort of a meditation. You know, it's an alternate world that I can go hang out in that I'm writing, quite literally. And I will just love the way it's like a dream that you can control and live in. I really do fully submerse into it when I'm doing it. And it's interesting that you mentioned time, because my perception of time gets as altered as it would if I were on LSD. And it's that strong for me. And of course, one of the great things about, you know, writing is time is completely up to you. You can write about, take 300 pages to write about 5 minutes, or you can take 5 pages to write about 300 years. You know, it's completely up to you as to how you do it. And both are completely satisfactory, and you can mix the two. And that's usually what a decent writer does. So, I think for me as a kid, it was almost like something I did in the way that somebody else might watch a movie. I actually didn't watch that many movies. And I read books, but I would rather write, you know.
And are you finding that to be truly creative, you need to slow it down in the writing process?
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting. To be truly creative, do I need to slow it down in the actual act of writing it?
Not that you can't write quickly, because yeah. I think ideas come and you can't get them on the page as fast as they're in your brain. Uh-huh. More like...
Well, I can actually, because I took typing.
Oh, so you're a good typer.
And I have to say... I think that every kid out there should be taught touch typing. I see them hunting, pecking. I'm like, it's no way to live.
voice recognition is getting pretty good. Okay. So we just have to talk.
It's not the same talking, though.
No, it's not.
No.
It's not. No, I more mean that you need to sort of not be involved in multiple activities. You need to sort of slow down and get into a specific space. Time needs to shift a little bit.
I need, yes. And I would say, if I were getting paid by the hour as a writer for things that I might one day show, you know, I need to feel like really compelled to show it to people in order to show it to people. Otherwise, I just think, well, that's something I did for myself. But I do have something I'm working on now that I'll end up doing that. If I think about the per hour rate, I mean, it's next to zero, you know.
Well, it's this idea, like, you know, Einstein talked about time being this illusion in the theory of relativity from 1915. And he, you know, he predicted that time passes more quickly when you're high up than if you're nearer to the earth. You know, so if you had a twin and... this is when, from Carlo Rovelli's book, The Order of Time, I think he opened
it. And they were living on the top of Mount Everest and I was at sea level.
Yeah. You guys would be a different age.
Is that like centripetal force being a little further away from the Earth's surface?
Your sibling would be slightly older than you, you know. But, you know, that there isn't this absolute true time. There are these kind of multitudes of nows.
So funny. My daughter and I talk about this all the time. She actually just wrote a play that's like a kind of Samuel Beckett kind of play. And it's all about time and words. But we talk about time all the time in my house. Yeah, to me, it's completely obvious that it's something that is not an absolute, but is perceived, you know. We all know it. We've all felt time go really fast and felt it go really slow. The only way we have of dealing with the world is through perception. If there's an absolute, nobody knows about it. Nobody's experiencing it. So why deal with it?
Well, there's this thing that's happening. I think, you know, we're hearing about it a lot now and we're all clearly thinking about it. But the sort of weaponization of time. It's like sort of violence
it.
And through the smartphone, through technology, and the convenience economy. I mean, we're living in this Amazon convenience economy.
So that's actually something I drop out of over the summer. Yeah.
Well,
I drop in and out, but yeah.
You drop in and out. You drop in and out of technology. Uh-huh. One of the things that I admire about you is you don't believe in too much.
No.
For too long.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, so I'm not going to like, it's not like I'm a Luddite and I'm just going to be like, dismiss all of it and walk away. I do that sort of so that when I come back, I can appreciate what is actually valuable because there's such a flood of all of it. I go, what is actually valuable? Well, I started carrying my phone again, partly because that way I can video the guy on the subway. Because for a while I wasn't. And I was like, oh, I really would love to share that because that's cool. You know, but if you're just using it to look at the latest CNN, whatever happened, then we're all just like.
I think your relationship to technology is completely, completely related to your protection of your own time. Mm-hmm. It's that the technology becomes at times a sort of a villain against your own sense of time.
Yeah. Well, what's interesting is the way that everybody tries to do everything at once, right? I mean, it's called multitasking or whatever, but like, you know, I think people run with headphones on listening to a podcast because they think that they've just gained an hour by doing something that could have taken 2 hours. But I would say you've just lost everything, you know, because you've experienced neither as completely as you could have.
So I wanted to come back really, really quickly to your sort of origin story, because it's unique, and I think it's informed sort of who you are today. Obviously, you were born on an Air Force base.
I was
in Illinois.
Yep,
and you're an only child.
I am. Yep,
and you moved 12 times.
Yep. From birth, yeah. Until I was 18. Yeah. So, you know, so my dad worked for three places, right? My dad worked for the Air Force. Then he worked for, wait for it, Monsanto.
Brilliant.
Wonderful place. I think he saw what was going on and split. Then he worked for IBM, which also stands for I've Been Moved. So those three places are all famous for sending people everywhere. It's not that I grew up on bases all over the place. It's that, you know, I had a father that was extremely good at computers. And so he was a valuable person during that time, you know. And what was interesting is, like, I think I've always thought of St. Louis as being an important place for me for some reason. I also, you know, Ramona just read like Mark Twain, Huckleberry Finn.
Your daughter, Ramona.
Yeah, my daughter, Ramona, just read that. And I was like, you know, Hannibal is right there. I was born right there. And I'm like, I really connect with that character. There's something about, I've always really liked Samuel Clemens. You know, I get it. I understand how, you know, there's some dated stuff, including with race and stuff in there. But like, there's a fundamental feeling of being American that is in there that I really identify with. I mean, because of my last name, it's funny, people frequently think of me as being like Scandinavian. It's way, way back. My parents are from Mississippi. And, you know, they met in Mississippi. And my dad went to Mississippi State. My mom went to University of Mississippi for Women. They dated in college. And so, I really connected with that feeling, the Mississippi River, St. Louis, the heart of the country, some interesting modern architecture. You know, there was like, culturally, it was pretty vibrant in its own way.
But you learned how to hang out with yourself.
Totally learned how to hang out with myself. I mean, I moved to Oklahoma. I lived there for a year and a half, I think. at one point, and I had everyone call me John, just because that's my first name is John Peter Sarsgaard, but my dad's name's John, so he never called me John. But I just thought, like, I know we're not going to be here for long. I'm going to try out John. I fought in Oklahoma. Like, I messed around with after school brawls.
How old are you?
I was 10 and 11. Yeah. So I got in my first and only fights were in Oklahoma. And this was like right at the end of an oil boom. DeLoreans were rusting out on the side of the street. There were lots of homeless people. It was not a good time for Oklahoma. My dad actually always says, thank God IBM had this thing where if they moved you, they would buy your house and be responsible for selling it. And they bought it, had an appraiser come, and they bought it at the appraiser's value. My dad was like, there is no way we would have gotten half that. So like, he was psyched, and we moved from there. And what was after that? Ridgefield, Connecticut. And, you know, in Connecticut, everybody played lacrosse, and there's like a whole style thing going on there with like polo shirts and stuff and collars up that I, and OP, and music that I wasn't aware of, you know. So I really value that. I think having all of that time, tons of time by myself, and I would frequently have like an influencer, you know, whether it be Eli or this guy Andy Flynn, who helped me really explore music that I wouldn't have known about. I would frequently find those people that were local that would be like my tastemaker. You know what I mean? And that's what I really got into. Who's going to be the person who's going to give me the inside? Andy Flynn took me on my first trips to New York City. He had a girlfriend in the Bronx. And we would go down, and my first trips to New York City were all to the Bronx. And I saw like the Pogues play and stuff, and I got into that. But it wasn't because I didn't end up a lifelong Pogues fan. I was for a moment a Pogues fan. I still respect them, you know. But like it frees you up because the people around you, I think, even the people that love you define you. And when they define you, it can be like a cage, you know. And luckily, you know, my parents, God bless them, you know, never defined me. Like, you know, they were like, who knows what the hell's going on with Peter type of thing. It wasn't like Peter's like that. A lot of people thought of me as a soccer player. I never identified as an athlete. I just thought I thought of soccer as something that was incredibly beautiful. I thought of it as like really one of the most beautiful games I'd ever seen, including like chess or, you know, any of the great games.
Informed by your ballet training.
Informed by my ballet training. Exactly. Well, I'm really into balance, and I'm really into like what they call proprioception, where your body is in space. And so that understanding of where my body is in space has made it so that I feel perfectly comfortable running down the stairs in the dark, because I've known those stairs a million times. I feel it like a
You studied thing. Modern dance.
You studied modern dance. I performed here in the city with Meredith Monk. Yeah, these are all little rabbit holes that I got down. But I would say like dance and sport, to me, I remember talking to Matthew Barney about this a little bit. I think he has an idea about an arena and space and rules and stuff. But like for me, the whole thing was really about proprioception. It was really like my connection with a ball and whatever little angles I'm touching it at in space, sending it to someone who's going a speed behind me toward an open space to have it land in the right spot. And if they hit it one touch into the goal, it's beauty. If we win because it's an own goal or because we just like lots of slide tackles and stuff, I hated it. I hated it so much I thought about quitting it all the time. So I would say a lot of things are like that for me. Like with acting, there have been times where I went through hating it so much because it wasn't beautiful or it wasn't meaningful or it wasn't valuable. I couldn't find the value in this manifestation of it, you know, and that's, I would actually say, where I become a professional. That's where you go. I know what to do to just patch this up a little bit.
Well, you're to go all the way from sort of Mississippi and Illinois and St. Louis and all these early spaces you pass through, you find yourself at Bard College.
Uh-huh. I went to Bard College for 1 year. And I was a completely different person than most. See, I was never a hip person. I did lots of interesting things, but I had a, I didn't have an outside me looking at me. So I didn't dress. I wore my dad's clothes a lot of the time as I got older, because I just was never, I didn't think about my personal style or what I looked like. Or I look back at pictures of myself and there's like a, and I was guileless that way for a long time. Until I met my mentor for doing that, you know what I mean? Which happened at a certain moment. I actually think right around Boys Don't Cry is when I started to think about what I looked like.
Which is where I was getting to. It's interesting you bring that up.
Yeah, but the people that I met doing Boys Don't Cry, you know, and even the topic of Boys Don't Cry were something that I only became aware of because I went to Bard, because at the all-boys school that I went to in Connecticut, nobody talked about transgender anything. Nobody would have watched this movie. Nobody would have watched Boys Don't Cry. So, and I probably, when I read it, wouldn't have made head or tails of what was going on with it. Except that I went to Bard, met lots of people that were all over the map in terms of that stuff. And even now, it's something that I don't feel like I understand quite as well as like my kids do. My daughter does, certainly. For her, it's just a fact of life. For me, it's like something new still. So yeah, when Boys Don't Cry came along, I went, those were like Bard people to me. Kim Pierce was like, oh, I was like, you'd be at Bard. Kelly Reichardt was at Bard. You know, there were, Stephen Shore was at Bard. Lots of interesting artists were there that I got access to and became, it's, yeah, this is just a quick aside. When I listened on tape to Patti Smith's book about coming to New York, I listened to her doing it.
Just kids.
The way that she talked about seeing Cézanne and the masters and all that, if you're knowledgeable about art, you're sophisticated about art, you can see the, to me, what is the beauty in her guilelessness about it. Her, it's a naive point of view where you can look at a Van Gogh and go, that's a beautiful picture, instead of being like, yeah, it's a Van Gogh. I've seen it 1,000 times.
Van Gogh.
So I was still in that guileless place for a long time where everything was fresh to me like that. And I think that was all the way up to right around the time of Boys Don't Cry, when I met a pack of people that were super aware of kind of a cult of cool. And of the way you appear, not just what you wear, but the way you act in that clothing, the way you, that you could have a persona, that glamour is an illusion.
But it never really stuck for you.
I was never good at it.
Yeah, but you never wanted to be.
It didn't interest me enough to do it myself. It was interesting enough that I hung around it for some period of time. I mean, like, Sonic Youth is really interesting. You know, sometimes they sound good, sometimes they don't sound good, but like even when they don't sound good, they're interesting, you know.
Well, Boys Don't Cry and playing John Lotter was certainly a turning point for you.
Yeah.
And when I think about that film, it's been a long time since I took a look at it, but when I think about it, it was 1999, I think, right? When I think about that film, I think about you playing a kind of despicable human being.
Mm-hmm.
But somehow as the audience, you don't think of that person as despicable. And that dissonance is where the beauty of that role in that film really is.
Okay. I'm going to open this. Yeah. Let me pour this.
Sounds pretty good, actually,
right?
Sounds
great. John Lotter was such a familiar person to me when I read it that in some way he was the only familiar person in the script to me. Like, I didn't know anyone like Brandon Tina, and I didn't know anyone like Chloe's character, you know? But I knew plenty of these guys. And I'd hung around them. And I'd also hung around people that did morally reprehensible things, despicable things, bigoted things. And because I was where I was at the time, I didn't say anything. Sometimes my wife actually says I bait them into being even more authentically who they are. And I do think I do that. I think I will see just how far it goes instead of trying to change their minds about something they've believed forever or even shame them. It's a kind of curiosity that I have. I want to know. It's like I met this guy in a driver in Louisiana once. He said, "You want to see the lower Ninth Ward?" And it was after the hurricane. I said, "All right." And he's driving me and my wife around. And the way he was talking about it made me say this. Was the hurricane a little bit like a cleansing for this neighborhood? And he said, "Yeah. Yeah, it was a cleansing. And this neighborhood's never coming back. And you know what? It's not such a bad thing. Them people shouldn't have been living there. We don't need those people here. And New Orleans is better for it. It's smaller, but it's better." And then you read about like the way that people were shot on the bridge there and stuff. And you go like, oh, that's where that comes from. This is hardcore. This isn't like, you have to get curious about bigotry. You have to get curious about racism in order to know how to deal with it.
This is Sacha Cohen's career.
Exactly. Except I do it with no humor.
You just do it socially.
I just do it socially.
You don't ever do it when anything's recording.
No. And so, yeah, when I read John Lotter, I was like, 100% I could play this totally. And I also thought to myself, God, no, it's too bad no one's going to see this movie.
You were wrong about that.
Yeah.
And I think there's a lot of moments of your career that are interesting, but another kind of turning point was Shattered Glass.
Yeah.
And one of the things that sticks in my mind about Shattered Glass is when I first noticed your ability to do absolutely nothing.
Yeah.
And create stakes on screen.
Well, that's called good writing. That's also working with Billy Ray.
When you don't say anything.
Right. But that's because I know, as an actor, that the mechanisms, the tsunami of the plot, the structure of what is behind me requires me to do nothing. Doesn't mean I have to do nothing. Just doesn't mean I have to do something. So I keep track mostly of scenes where I go like, I have to make sure, and this is like being a pro and kind of a drag, that they see that I saw that and that's going to make me do this, right? Like, I saw that she'd been beaten up. I know who beat her up. We see me walk out the door. After I do that, we know where I'm going. I'm going to go find the dude and beat the shit out of him, right? Like, that's storytelling. What's great when you work with a real pro sometimes, and Billy Ray is a real pro with the writing and directing, is you have less responsibility. And so you are able to do that. And I would say the thing I'm good at knowing is like, yeah, I've been writing stories to myself since I was a kid. I know, gosh, I'm writing a story right now where I just started to realize that there were 20 pages in it where just no explanation was necessary because I had created such a strong tsunami of inevitability behind the story. It was just, in a way, to hold it up, created the tension. To have, it's, oh, now there's just a scene with people eating. Now there's a scene with people bathing. Oh my God, it's growing behind them. And you can know as a storyteller that that's a time you can just lay off, you know?
Hamlet.
Mm-hmm.
So you had done three, actually, you've done a lot of theater.
Yeah. Yeah.
Beautifully. Three amazing Chekhov.
Yeah.
Experiences, Uncle Vanya, Three Sisters, The Seagull. It started with The Seagull.
I would clarify and say, regardless of the quality of what they were to anyone, they were three great experiences, you know? So people like things, people don't like things, but of that, I'm certain that the experiences were great.
And then you did Hamlet.
Yeah, yeah.
And I bring up Hamlet because of another sort of experience in your life where you were able to really stretch time through the process of prep.
Yeah.
I mean, how long did you prepare for Hamlet? Better question. How long was the book on your person?
Oh, over a year. Yeah, a little over a year. Maybe even, yeah. I just carried it with me all the time for a long time. And I'd read it on the subway. It's not a matter of reading the whole thing over and over. I would linger for weeks at a time over a section. And, you know, I knew the whole thing. And then I would read the whole thing maybe twice a month. But then daily, I would jump ahead and go like, how about that scene where he talks about the handwriting? It's a good thing that, Horatio, that I learned good handwriting in school and that I paid attention in that class so that I could forge the letter really well that ended up killing our childhood friends. You go like, what's that about? And that's actually a section that, you know, the one I just described, for example, to me, the most interesting parts of it were always the ones that I didn't know the answer to. And I did that part on stage, and I couldn't really tell you why he tells his best friend that accept is a way of trying to bring up something that he feels uncomfortable about having done. You know, he's saying, I killed our friends. I killed those guys that we knew back in school. Is that okay?
And the final thing I wanted to talk to you about, and I saved it for last, is politics.
Uh-huh.
So back to what you were saying about how our friends in a way, or the company we keep in a way, is almost like the aggregate of our portrait.
Mm-hmm.
It's like the roadmap to our life in a way.
Yeah.
And you've had some pretty interesting political friends.
Mm-hmm.
And the one I think of as being the most interesting, if I was going to put a hierarchy on it, would be Jeremy Scahill.
That's exactly who I thought you'd say, yeah.
And so...
And I've actually kind of performed for him, you know, on his podcast. You know, I read those NSA papers, internal NSA documents, which were just unbelievably... I mean, if you can laugh at Guantanamo, which is very hard to do, but...
What have you learned from your time with Jeremy?
The very interesting thing about Jeremy is in a time of just like where everybody's on one side or the other, Jeremy, to me, now this is very easy for me to say, Jeremy will criticize a Republican or Democrat almost in the same breath, equally. Jeremy is no great believer in the drone strikes of Obama. And Jeremy certainly is no great believer in anything that Trump does. But what, so when I think of Jeremy and I, you know, so that's on the surface, then I really think of him. And as I go back to like the Catholic workers movement of which he springs out of and some of the literature that he's given me and our conversations about Thomas Merton and really going back to why he does what he does, it's there's no amount of this sort of like frothing, gossipy, vicious rancor. If you listen to his podcast, actually, sometimes it's funny and he seems like he seems like he's enjoying what he's doing on some level because he really believes in it. And if you get him in front of a room full of people, which I saw in Bushwick, he is a fantastic motivator. He's because no matter what you believe, you can find something in what he says. He's really defending not just America, but like people, the right to happiness. You know, actually, he and I were talking about Helen and Scott Nearing, which is another thing that we had talked about earlier. And, you know, that book, The Good Life, that they wrote. So these are people that during the Depression dropped out of society because it was too hard to live in the city for the price of an axe, got a piece of land in Vermont, an area that was not particularly valuable, and really structured their lives with almost no money to live a happy life doing what they wanted to do. They lived off the land, but they tried to make it easy. They had other people come and take the maple syrup off their trees and boil it down and make the maple syrup. And they got a cut of it in exchange for letting them use these trees, which they gotten for the price of an axe. So that idea of the good life, that we are all entitled to the good life. And what is the real way that all of us, not just in America, but how we can make sure as many people as possible across everywhere has an opportunity to have the good life. It doesn't mean the rich life. Helen and Scott Nearing were not wealthy, but they had time for love. They had time for music. They had time for all these things, which brings us back to what I say W.S. Merwin had, because I was told he was raised wealthy. He had time for poetry. Who else can write a poem like that than has all the hours in the day to walk around thinking about it and not worrying about their daily sustenance? To give all of us the opportunity to be artists, to be, you know, grow an apple tree, to learn a musical instrument. All of these things, I think, are not like the side part of life. I think of them as the main part of life. Acting to me is, you know, like I said, the manifestation of all that I do the rest of my time, but it's just the tip of the iceberg. Hopefully, wouldn't it be great if more people had the opportunity to have that? And I really want to stress that I'm not talking about money, because I really do think, and I know some people, you know, up in Vermont where the Nearings were, in and around there, that live on very little, but are putting their energy toward their children, their spouses, the land around them, whatever floats their boat, whatever makes their mind expand.
I think that's where we'll end.
All right.
Thank you.
No problem. Yeah.
It was fun to have you on.
Absolutely. Really fun to be on.
Thanks for listening. You can find more episodes of the Time Sensitive Podcast on our website, timesensitive.fm, or on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and Stitcher. You can follow us on Instagram at slowdown.tv.